Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument on petitioner in McDonald ISD versus Davis.
May it please the court. Mr. Thompson will present arguments for the petitioner. The petitioner has 3 minutes for rebuttal. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Thompson. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of the petitioner in this case, the Montgomery Independent School District.
Mr. Thompson, before you get into the specific issues that your petition brought to the court,
yes, Your Honor.
Would you please procedurally and from an appellate standard of review perspective tell us how we get to those issues? In other words, what is it that we are reviewing and under what standard?
I appreciate that question, Your Honor, and it is somewhat confusing.
Yes, that's why I was asking it.
And it's an issue that is addressed several different ways, not only in the briefs of the parties, but in the amicus brief submitted as well. This is a case of first impression, we believe, to get to this court involving a comprehensive new hearing structure that was put in place by the legislature in 1995 with the enactment of Senate Bill 1. The purpose of Senate Bill 1 was to divide responsibility between the state and local districts with regard to educational matters. The state very definitely took the responsibility through the accountability and accreditation system to set the standards, our outcomes, our objectives, our targets for public education, and to devolve to local districts the responsibility to actually implement or carry out the functioning of the educational system. Under this new system, one of the components was to try to streamline the hearing process, and so a new process was put in place. It's analogous and similar in many respects to the Administrative Procedures Act, but it is specifically exempted by statute from the Administrative Procedures Act. The Commissioner of Education maintains a list of independent hearing examiners who are appointed in different cases. We believe the hearing examiner is not a decision maker, that the sole function of the independent hearing examiner is to prepare the best possible record and present that to the board so that the board, as the decision maker, can make an informed decision. There are obviously limitations attached in statute to the review that the board has over the decision of the independent hearing examiner. Obviously, on any questions of law or questions of policy, the board is not bound.
Now, your position hinges
yes.
on the board's ability to make additional findings.
There are two issues, Your Honor, and on the issue of additional findings, I want to make clear, in her original petition to the commission, the respondent in this case did not even contest the ability of the board to make additional fact findings. That issue has sort of joined this case as it's gone through the
process. But your argument presumes that ability.
It does presume that ability, Your Honor.
Right. And if, in fact, the board has the authority to make additional findings,
yes.
which is not specified in the statute, that they have that authority, but if, in fact, they do have that authority, then doesn't that subvert the review set forth in the statute, because then you could make inconsistent findings always and it would be a de novo sort of determination?
I don't believe it subverts the statute, Your Honor. I believe it's exactly what the statute contemplates. The other view is that the function of the independent hearing examiner is, in essence, just like a trial court hearing a case without a jury. And if an independent hearing examiner only has to make the findings to support his or her recommendation, then you've hamstrung the board. There's no reason for the board to even be in the process.
Well, but the education. I want to get back to my original question, because I don't know that we've answered it yet. But just to follow up at this point in time, it's the board's option whether or not to use a hearing examiner. The board could continue to conduct the hearing if the teacher requests it the way it always was, with the board actually hearing the evidence and going forward.
In this type of case.
Exactly. In a non-renewal case, I realize it's different for a termination, but in a non-renewal case, the board could continue to do that. Right?
Correct.
So if the board makes the decision to use this process, and I presume that they choose to do that for reasons like you were saying, that it streamlines the process and they don't have to spend their time in 5 days in a evidentiary hearing and all of that kind of thing. And yet, at the same time, provision of 21.259, which says what the board does when the record, findings of fact, and conclusions come back to the board after the hearing, says that the board announces its decision via findings and conclusions and its disposition, whether there'll be a, whether the contract will be non-renewed or not. But then the subsequent provisions restrict what the board can do vis-a-vis the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Now, I agree with you, Mr. Thompson, that they're the decision maker. The hearing officer has no authority to non-renew a teacher or to order renewal of her contract. But is all the hearing examiner doing acting as a court reporter and taking down the record, or doesn't the statute, in fact, put some parameters in 21.259 on the board vis-a-vis what it can do once it makes the choice to use a hearing examiner?
The independent hearing examiner is much more than simply a transcriber of the testimony and the evidence. We believe that what 21.259 states is that in those cases, and there is a very narrow constriction on the board, in those cases where the independent hearing examiner actually makes findings, the board is not supposed to disturb those findings if they're supported by substantial evidence. Now, that means that the independent hearing examiner should make the broadest range of findings possible and present the best view of the record to the board so that the board can make an informed decision. Because if the hearing examiner makes a finding on an issue, the board can't disturb it if it is supported by substantial evidence.
But I believe you're arguing that they can find additional facts that are inconsistent with and therefore de facto subvert those findings, which was my question. Isn't that against the statutory scheme?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. And in this particular case, we are not asserting the right to make inconsistent fact findings.
Well, but aren't you? Because didn't the hearing examiner look at the two pieces, the two facts that you found? Didn't he attach the testimony and his reasoning on why he concluded as he did?
Well, let's look at what he said and what he didn't say. The additional fact findings, and there are three of them.
Right.
One of the fact findings that the board added dealt with derogatory comments made about students.
I realize he didn't deal with that.
Right, which, very candidly, every professional witness who testified said that was inappropriate and unprofessional. And we believe that it is extremely inappropriate for the independent hearing examiner simply to leave that evidence out. Now, on the other two issues, on the issue of the additional fact-finding that the board made, which is, we believe, uncontested and not inconsistent with the fact-findings made, that Ms. Davis, there were more requests for transfers about out of her place.
But the hearing examiner found, didn't he deal with that and say that they had gone down and that was improving and therefore determined that that was insufficient to support non-renewal?
What the hearing examiner found was that in the fall of 1995, the school year in question, 95-96 school year, that out of six instances, there were three that actually resulted in transfers out of her class. And his conclusion was, I don't think that's a big deal. What he ignored was the testimony in the record about how many requests for transfers.
But didn't
it was not persuasive to him, so he chose not to make a fact finding on it. If he's acting as the finder of fact, it's his obligation.
There is no question if it is contested, the hearing examiner on evidentiary fact findings, as opposed to policy making or legislative fact findings or ultimate fact findings, whatever you want to call them, that he weighs the evidence if it's contested. We believe it's uncontested.
But even if it's uncontested,
there were many more
if it's
requests.
Uncontested, he could. It seems apparent from reviewing what the hearing examiner provided to the school board, that the hearing examiner decided that the principal was not particularly credible, that the principal was out to get the teacher. Is that kind of a safe kind of characterization?
There is no doubt that the hearing examiner's perspective was exactly as you characterized it.
Well, and so if that were the case, and the hearing examiner was, after hearing these several days' worth of testimony, was led towards that view of the evidence that was presented, then perhaps he did not find credible the undisputed evidence about requests for transfers. And wouldn't he, even in the face of undisputed evidence, be free to reject that and not incorporate it in his findings of fact? And instead he incorporated, as Justice O'Neill pointed out, he did deal with the area. He dealt with it in the way that he viewed the evidence.
I would agree if it were contested. I am uncomfortable with the notion that an independent hearing examiner, if there is uncontested evidence presented in record, can simply refuse to pass it on to the board for the board to even consider that evidence. In this particular case, the assistant principal testified that in the fall of 1995, following immediately an open house at which Ms. Davis spoke to her class or the parents of her class, that he immediately received over 20 requests for transfer.
Let me just ask
that. And that simply left out of the...
You would agree that there was substantial evidence to support the hearing examiner's determinations?
There is substantial evidence to support those that are true findings of fact. With regard to finding of fact number 17, we do not believe that's properly characterized as a finding of fact.
Well, but if it is, regardless of what it's characterized as, right, that you would agree that there's substantial evidence to support it.
Yeah, I would agree that there is substantial evidence if that is a finding of fact. I understand the threshold of the substantial evidence.
Let me ask you about the substantial evidence analytical framework.
Yes.
So far, the discussion has gone along the lines that we apply these substantial evidence tests to what the hearing examiner did. According to the amicus brief by the Association of School Boards, and according to a different paradigm, the substantial evidence test does not apply to what the hearing examiner concludes, but instead is applied to what the commissioner concludes.
Right.
What is your position on that? And if, in fact, it is applied to what the commissioner does, isn't it irrelevant then what the hearing examiner finds?
It's not clear from the posture of this case whose decision is being reviewed. And it is our position that it's a matter of statute, that by operation of statute, the commissioner did in fact affirm the decision of the Montgomery Independent School District, and that it is the commissioner's decision that has therefore been appealed.
And that
I understand that's not everybody's position as to which.
And under these cases, when it's affirmed as a matter of law as opposed to by actual decision, analyzing what happened below, does that then mean that we are actually reviewing the board's decision because it became the commissioner's decision? Is that how we look? This takes me back to my original question, Mr. Thompson. Is that what we're doing?
Functionally, I think it's to some extent immaterial. It's a very confusing issue, but I believe you have two questions of law, which obviously this court can review, which are truly legal issues, and you're not bound by a prior determination. The first question of law is whether so-called fact-finding 17, which is simply a restatement of policy.
And I understand that, Mr. Thompson, but I'm just trying to figure out conceptually. We've got five levels of review below us.
Yep.
We have a hearing examiner, the board, the commissioner, the district court by statute, that has actual, at each level, there's a requirement for how it's
reviewed.
And it's a different one at each level. So then we go from the commissioner to the district court to the court of appeals. And that was my threshold question is, you say that you are presenting two legal questions.
Right.
Even if we answer those questions in your favor, what does our conclusion look like in this case in terms of what we are reviewing and the grounds for reversing the Court of Appeals judgment and, in fact, going with what the commissioner did vis-a-vis affirming the board's decision? I don't know what the conclusion looks like given that review framework.
I think the conclusion is that as a matter of law, the characterization of finding of fact 17 is incorrect. And that as a matter of law, finding of fact 17, which purports to be a construction or interpretation or application of board policy, is more properly characterized as either a conclusion of law or as a legislative fact-finding, if we were in an Administrative Procedures Act construct, and that the authority of the board to interpret its own policies is not only critical but needs to be preserved. I would comment.
And then, therefore, having decided that the board acted properly in treating that finding as a conclusion, there is substantial evidence to support the board's decision to non-renew on the grounds that she did not have good rapport with parents?
I believe there is.
Is that what our conclusion looks like?
I believe so. I believe even, and obviously if the board has the authority to make additional fact findings, that determination is much easier.
Right.
But even on the fact findings as made by the independent hearing examiner. Now, the independent hearing examiner, to the extent he addressed the limited question of how many requests for transfers there were, his conclusion, I mean, even the facts as he found them were, I find there were three, but I don't think that's a big deal. Now, the board, we believe, is entitled to look at that fact-finding and say, well,
they can reject it if there's not substantial evidence.
Well, the fact-finding is that there were three actual transfers, not requests for transfers, but three in a semester that actually resulted in transfers. The opinion that I don't think that's a big deal is not a fact finding by the independent hearing examiner. In other words, the board is entitled to decide how important in the context of Montgomery ISD.
Well, doesn't that a bit beg the question? Because I agree with that if you had decided as a board to have the hearing in the first instance. You're more of a policy tribunal in that sense.
Right.
But the fact that you chose to have the hearing examiner decide it, doesn't your role change?
I think the ultimate responsibility of the board to construe and apply its own policies, the role of the board to speak for its community, is a question of law. The interpretation of policies is never devolved to the independent hearing examiner. I would like to read in just a very briefly.
I have another question, Mr. Chief Justice. Isn't what's really before us when we get to your underlying issue a statutory interpretation? I understand you have the general policy questions, but isn't this actually a question of statutory interpretation of 21.259 of the Education Code?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, now what language in that provision do you hang your hat on to say that the board has the authority to make additional findings, number one, and number two, to convert a finding of fact into a conclusion of law? What in 21.259 gives the board the authority to do that?
The authority to make additional fact findings is the reserved powers. As this court said in 1996.
So it's not in 21.259. We can't look to the language of 21.259 to find that.
No, you're right. We believe the clear statutory scheme is that the broad grant of power and what is now 11151B is given to the local boards. The reservation of power is at the local level. The limitation is at the state level. That's
okay.
A clear concept.
But if under 21.259 the board exercises its discretion to use the hearing examiner, then by doing that, it has also accepted the limitations upon itself that go with how it makes its decision under 21.259 after the independent hearing examiner forwards his or her results,
yes,
correct?
Ma'am.
Okay, so,
yes.
So that takes me back to 21.259, and my question to you again is, what language in the statute are you asking us to look at that would give the board the authority to make additional findings and to treat a finding as a conclusion?
With regard to the additional fact findings, the only language in 21.259 that limits the board is in those cases where the independent hearing officer actually makes fact findings.
And we have
that
here.
The board is not to disturb those. In any other case where an independent hearing examiner simply doesn't address an issue, there is no limitation on the board in statute to make, but the board is actually required under 21258 to review the record.
Right. So your point is that because the statute doesn't address it, they have the ability to do it under their reserved power.
The silence of statute works to the benefit of the local board. The reservation of power is at the local level. In absence of prohibition, the authority of the board, the responsibility of the board to review the record as they're required to do by statute and to make additional fact findings, we believe is inherent in the scheme.
Well, let me ask you, if you disagree with this analysis, the framework for appealing a case like this is that the last decision before it goes to court is the decision made by the commissioner, correct?
Correct.
And because of that, isn't it true that the issue at the district court level is whether or not what the commissioner did was supported by substantial evidence?
That should have been the question.
And the CA did not, the CA applied that question at the board level. Would you agree?
I think that's correct. And again, I think that is the confusion as to whose decision is actually moving through the process.
Our position is that it's
the commissioner's decision that is under review.
Because that's substantial difference, and that's a big question.
No question. That makes a huge difference.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Governor.
The court is ready to hear from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Lungwith will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. Lungwith, if we do have to review the commissioner's decision under substantial evidence review, do you lose?
No, Your Honor, and actually the standard of review cited in the amicus brief, Texas Association of School Boards, does not give the complete picture. It's not just a substantial evidence review that the district court applies to the commissioner's decision. It's substantial evidence review or whether the commissioner applied erroneous conclusions of law. That's a big difference, and that's missing in the TASB amicus brief from the standard of review from district court to the commissioner.
Do you agree that that the district court, in fact, should have reviewed the commissioner's decision, that that's really what at issue once this left the administrative side and headed into the judicial system?
That, according to the statute, Justice Hankinson, that is correct. And I guess the only thing that my colleague and I will agree on today is that that is a little confusing what happens when the commissioner did not issue a formal written decision. I'm rather flexible on that issue, to tell you the truth. There's no doubt about it. The teacher has a right to appeal to district court, and the district court can review the commissioner's decision for erroneous conclusions of law, which if the commissioner, by not issuing a decision, affirmed the school board's decision, which concluded, made erroneous conclusions of law, A, that they can add facts, or B, that a fact-finding is a conclusion, those in and of themselves are conclusions of law that are freely reviewable on appeal all the way up to this court. I think it needs to be made clear, and Justice O'Neill has already picked up on it, that everything that this school board is seeking from this court to be able to do with Ms. Davis's case, it could have done, but it voluntarily opted out of holding the hearing in front of itself and instead converted it to a what we call a subchapter F hearing examiner case.
If the law is that they give up substantial policy control over decisions like this by doing that, how will that affect their use of this procedure?
Well, Your Honor, they would obviously have the right not to use it next time in a non-renewal context. And to tell you quite frankly,
wouldn't that hurt teachers?
Well, to tell you quite frankly, Justice Hecht, in a non-renewal context, very few school districts use this process. It is used, of course, at the right of the teacher in a mid-contract termination case. But in a non-renewal case, it is the school district's option. And I think it would actually hurt teachers more for this court to find that once that process is engaged, the school district can cast it aside and do as it wishes.
Well, no, that hasn't happened, because if you look under 21301, when the appeal goes from what the school district does to the commissioner, the teacher has the opportunity to have the hearing before the commissioner.
Justice Abbott, I disagree that we get a hearing in front of the commissioner in one of these cases. The commissioner shall review the board's decision to see if it's arbitrary, capricious, or lacking substantial evidence, or makes erroneous conclusions of law, but there is no other hearing. And that is the whole idea of a subchapter F process that was implemented by the legislature in 95.
Let me ask you this. Under 21.301D, it says, in conducting a hearing under this section, the commissioner has the same authority relating to discovery and conduct of a hearing as a hearing examiner has under subchapter F.
Your Honor, I can tell you that I've been practicing under this law since it was implemented, and I've never seen that section used. My understanding of it is used in the very limited purpose where if procedural irregularities are alleged, the commissioner has a slim chance to hold a very limited evidentiary hearing on some procedural matters.
I mean, the reason you haven't seen it is because the commissioner doesn't do it, but if you look at subpart E, it says the commissioner may adopt rules governing the conduct of an appeal to the commissioner. So in other words, the commissioner can have a hearing and provide the teacher the opportunity with as full of a scope of the hearing as whatever the commissioner decides. Now, if we have a commissioner, as we may have had, and I don't know, who chooses not to have any hearings, well, that's going to obviously limit the scope of review. But this does seem to provide, in sections D and E, the commissioner with the widest possible latitude to provide as meaningful of a hearing to the teacher as the commissioner may want to provide.
I respectfully disagree, Justice Abbott. I think you have to read that in conjunction with 21302, which talks about the evidentiary hearing before the commission and how it is limited to procedural irregularities. And if we go on to 21303, we see here in subsection A, that is truly the commissioner's review authority of a school board decision when no procedural irregularities have been alleged. And it is admittedly a very deferential standard. The commissioner can only reject the school board's decision to non-renew a teacher if it is arbitrary, capricious, unlawful, or not supported by substantial evidence. I think even my colleague might agree that that does not allow the commissioner to hold a full-blown evidentiary hearing and to relitigate all the issues again before the commissioner.
What issues did you raise before the commissioner? You didn't argue this was a procedural irregularities case.
No, Your Honor.
What issues did you raise to the commissioner?
The two broad issues that this court is deciding today: whether the board can add facts, and whether the finding of fact 17 is a conclusion of law. Those are the two issues that we briefed before the commissioner, and those are the two issues that have followed.
Why aren't those procedural irregularities?
Procedural irregularities, I think those are issues of law, and I think there's other reviewing statutes that address reviewing issues of law.
But don't you think that what the school board did in disregarding finding of fact 17 is a procedural irregularity?
Well, I think that's absolutely a matter of law, whether finding of fact...
No, don't you think that what the school board did with response to finding of fact 17 was a procedural irregularity?
No, I believe it is a matter of law, not a procedural irregularity.
So you think that what the school board did was they did something as a matter of law? But if you do something as a matter of law, it could still be a procedural irregularity.
They issued a decision that was unlawful.
And that's a procedural irregularity, don't you agree?
I do not agree. I think a procedural irregularity is perhaps whether a witness is not excluded from the room during the hearing, things of that nature, and whether that could have led to an erroneous conclusion or a biased decision. These are pure issues of law. Whether a board can look at the statutory scheme and add new facts, or whether Mrs. Davis' failure to get along with other people is a fact or a conclusion of law for a court to decide, those in and of themselves are pure conclusions of law.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's suppose the hearing examiner there were a lot of evidence, and the hearing examiner had just two findings of fact that addressed a particular issue, for example, or issue number 17, but there was a lot more evidence in the record. Could the board, in determining whether there was substantial evidence to support what the hearing examiner had done, recite the other evidence in the record that the hearing examiner did not mention in the facts and say, based on this other evidence, we conclude that the finding was not supported by substantial evidence?
Well, I don't know if I'm completely following your question, but I do know that the substantial evidence test doesn't ask us to look at all the evidence that may be in favor of a contrary finding. It only asks us to look to see if the fact finding at hand is supported by more than a scintilla of evidence, and that's all. And you don't get to, I think that argument was raised earlier this morning in a case.
I didn't understand the substantial evidence test to be the same as legal sufficiency. Is that your position that it is?
I think whether substantial evidence exists is a legal question.
It's a legal question, but it's not the same as our no evidence standard, is it?
It is slightly more deferential than a no evidence standard. My understanding of a no evidence standard is that if there is a scintilla of evidence, you lose on no evidence. Substantial evidence says there has to be more than a scintilla. A scintilla plus a scintilla, and you've got substantial evidence. But it's still a highly deferential standard.
My question to you is, could the board do that? Could they say, well, the hearing examiner only looked at this evidence, and there's all this evidence, and we, after looking at this evidence, we conclude that the hearing examiner's decision was not supported by substantial evidence?
And my answer to you is no, they cannot do that.
I believe your opposing counsel conceded that there would have been substantial evidence to support the hearing examiner's award, but that their position depended on an additional finding.
Yes, Your Honor. That's the only way they can subvert the hearing examiner's finding is to make these additional facts. And by making additional facts finding additional facts out of a cold record, that would subvert the substantial limitations placed on the school board by the legislature.
My question is the procedure I described, would you equate that with finding additional facts as opposed to reviewing the record to see if it's supported by substantial evidence?
Absolutely. At any time,
if you lose on the two issues that are presented, which I think Mr. Thompson agrees are statutory interpretation questions, what is the result in this case?
If this court finds that whether Ms. Davis gets along with or got along with certain other people is actually a conclusion of law,
and if the school board can
board can add facts, mm-hmm. And they would need to add those facts. Otherwise, we have a naked conclusion of law that has no support in the findings. They need those facts to support that conclusion. My alternate argument is those facts do not support that conclusion. Whether Ms. Davis used a pejorative reference to a student in a private meeting after school with a principal says nothing to prove whether she got along with parents, the community, or colleagues. Whether she had six parental concerns and three requests for student transfers of the 147 students that she taught that year does not prove that she, or does not support the finding that she lacked or failed to maintain rapport, especially in the face of the hearing examiner's fact findings that there was an overwhelming, that Mrs. Davis won on that issue, that the greater weight of evidence was in her favor.
Well, if the standard is substantial evidence review is this deferential, do you actually get to the point where we get to the point where we say that in fact there is not substantial evidence to support those findings and conclusions?
I don't think we get to the point of applying substantial evidence to their findings. I don't think the question is whether their three additional findings are supported by substantial evidence. I think the question is whether their conclusion, their purported conclusion, is supported by the findings. I think there's a distinction there.
What does that review standard look like for us? What's that called?
Your Honor, I don't know what that's called.
What would it be called if we were back in the district court and we had invoked 21.307, which is the parameters for what the district court is supposed to do in reviewing the commissioner's decision? What does a decision like that look like? What standard is the trial court applying?
I think you would have to say that if these are jury questions, that they don't match up with the issues in the case and they do not support the issue. I confess I'm not sure of the technical standard you may be driving at, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask you.
I'm sorry.
If the evidence in the case is that she had a terrible relationship with one parent, A, we'll call her, and there's a dispute about whether she really did or not, and the hearing examiner found that she did, but that was not enough to show ineffective working relationship or failure to maintain good rapport with parents in the finding. But the board thought that one such example like that is enough. That's grounds for non-approval. Who gets to decide?
The board makes the ultimate decision, but they are significantly limited by the statutory scheme. If since it is a fact finding, whether she gets along with other people, we call this hearing examiner in. In fact, the school board called this hearing examiner in to run an evidentiary hearing, to apply the rules of evidence,
but to
view the credibility of the witnesses.
But to put a real fine point on it, he finds that it happened. It might not have happened. There's a dispute about it, but he finds, yes, indeed, that disagreement did exist and it was significant. But I don't think that's serious. Can he make that second finding, or is that the board's decision?
The board can review that second finding under substantial evidence standard.
Well, what is there to review? You either think it is or you think it isn't.
They would have to go back and see if that finding, his conclusion or finding that Ms. Davis got along with other people, is going to have support in the record or in his recommendation by substantial evidence. He's not, if his only finding, Your Honor, is that she, the only evidence in the case was that she had a horrible relationship with a parent.
He makes two findings. I'm not getting across here. The hearing examiner says, I find she had a terrible relationship with A. Next finding. I find that that is not a failure to have an effective working relationship or maintain good rapport with parents. Is that second finding something that he can make, or is that something the board must decide?
Since it is a finding of fact, that is something that he makes, subject to their substantial evidence review. We have to remember that in every teacher dismissal case, bar none, there's going to be someone somewhere who's got something unfavorable to say about a teacher, or we wouldn't be at the hearing in the first place.
And let me ask you about that. At the hearing with the hearing examiner, isn't it true that there was evidence concerning the three issues raised by the school district? One, the teacher made use of the pejorative term. That was evidence before the hearing examiner, correct?
Yes.
And there was evidence before the hearing examiner that there were, I forgot what it was, a lot of complaints, things like that about the teacher, correct?
There were six parental concerns.
Okay. Here's my question. With that being in the record before the hearing examiner, I'd like to focus your attention on section 21301C. And I'll let you take your time to get to it. The first two sentences, I think, are key. Under 21301C, it says, the commissioner shall review the record of the hearing before the hearing examiner, which would mean all of the evidence, and the oral argument before the Board of Trustees. Next sentence, except as provided in 21302, which doesn't matter, the commissioner shall consider the appeal solely on the basis of the local record and may not consider any additional evidence or issue. What those two sentences mean to me is that the commissioner, in making his decision, can rely upon all of the evidence that was presented to the hearing examiner and is not confined to the findings of fact or conclusions of law of the hearing examiner, but has the ability to look at all of the evidence that was presented and rely upon that in the commissioner making his decision. With that being the case, why then would it not be true that what our true focus really is whether or not there is substantial evidence supporting what the commissioner's conclusion was?
Your Honor, I think this statute that you've called my attention to allows the commissioner to have at his disposal the entire record of the case and the argument before the board, but he's still very limited by 21303 in reviewing the board's decision. Yes, he gets the hearing examiner transcripts. He gets the board's announcing of their decision, which is required to be reported by a court reporter. And he has all of these at his disposal in his office. Then he goes to 21303 and has to look and make the determination of whether the school board's decision was arbitrary, capricious, unlawful, or not supported by substantial evidence. And that is the only standard.
Mr. Lungwitz, let me reverse the order and following up on Justice Heck's question to you. Suppose that the Montgomery Independent School District establishes as its policy that if a teacher fails to get along with one parent in the classroom, the teacher's contract will not be renewed. And there's a dispute as to whether or not the teacher doesn't get along with that one parent and goes to the hearing examiner. The hearing examiner finds that the teacher failed to get along with one parent. Is it still your view that if the hearing examiner says, but that does not amount to a failure to get along with parents and cites this other, does that fact-finding that you call it in that second instance overcome the school district's policy that they will not be renewed if they fail to get along with one other person?
I think maybe, Justice Enoch, in that limited instance, I could concede that if the policy says one instance of failure and hearing examiner finds one instance of failure, we may be approaching more of something that looks more like a conclusion of law.
Suppose the policy now just says the teacher's failure to get along with parents will be a basis for non-renewal, and the hearing examiner looks at the contested evidence and decides that the teacher fails to get along with some parents, but then attempts to make another finding, but this does not amount to a failure to get along with parents. Isn't that the same problem?
It is not the same problem because the school district, by its policy, hasn't really defined or given any guidance to the hearing examiner. It is asking the hearing examiner to make this factual determination after weighing all of the evidence and the credibility of the witnesses.
But what makes the ill-defined nature of the policy a fact-finding as opposed to a specifically defined policy? And that goes to your, if they specifically define what is a failure to get along with parents, you say that's a legal conclusion ultimately. But if they don't define that, they state a more general policy, then that creates it a fact issue.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, that is the way I view it.
But Mr. Longwitz, following up on what Judge Enoch is talking about, let's say, I mean, I know that policy manuals are not written that specifically with the non-renewal grounds. They tend to be broader categories of wrongful conduct that's been identified. But if we do have one of those policies that says one instance is enough, you can be non-renewed for it, and you have evidence of one instance, and let's say if we do call it a fact-finding, and the hearing examiner says, I find that he or she did not commit that bad act, and wouldn't the school board under 21.259C be free to reject or change that finding of fact because it's not supported by substantial evidence?
If it truly was not supported by substantial evidence.
And similarly, if it were a conclusion of law, then the Board of Trustees would also be free to reject or change that conclusion of law since it did not reflect what the board policy was and what the evidence was. So if we have that kind of abuse by a hearing examiner. Again, I go back to statutory interpretation question. I'm trying to understand how the statute works. Is it your position that if we had that kind of record, the board would have the authority to then make the changes to fulfill its policy and then non-renew the teacher under that basis? Do you think that that's the way it would work, or am I misreading the statute?
I don't believe that, and maybe I misunderstood your question, Justice Hankinson. I apologize, but I don't believe there would be an opportunity for the school board to change its policy and then fire the
teacher. No, I'm not talking about changing the policy. I'm saying change the conclusion of law. If it is a conclusion of law, and the conclusion of law is written in terms of she didn't violate that specific policy.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then would the school board in that circumstance be free to change that conclusion of law to say he or she violated that policy and then, in fact, do their disposition, which would be to non-renew?
If the finding of fact at which the school board disagrees with is not supported by substantial evidence, they can change that finding of fact, essentially reverse it.
Okay.
Then they may make a conclusion of law also and reverse that conclusion of law. Now that conclusion would be supported by the finding. and we have a reasonable decision.
And they could non-renew, and so therefore the circumstance that Judge Enoch is talking about, the statute covers and allows the school board the ability to take care of that situation?
Yes, and I'm, okay. I believe
that's,
so, Your Honor.
That's the way you read the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. And in support of that, if I may, Chief Justice.
It's an answer to her question.
If I may, Justice okay. Hankinson. The Hunter Industries Facilities Incorporated versus TNRCC case is a little enlightening on that, where the administrative law judge found that 13 tons of hazardous waste, it had a number, 13 tons of hazardous waste did not present an obvious and substantial need under the agency's guidelines for a new hazardous waste disposal. Well, when we find when the ALJ is picking out a number, that doesn't make sense. And that when we get more specified with numbers, for instance, in the instance you gave me, one instance of failure to maintain rapport, then we want to let the school board perhaps make that decision.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Mr. Thompson, I want to go back to your delegation argument. What prohibits the school board from delegating this power that you are talking about? Is there anything that prohibits them from doing it, since you say that we have to look outside 21.259 and look at their retained power? Is there anything that prohibits them from delegating to the extent that your opponent wants us to read the statute?
Delegating to the independent hearing examiner?
Yes, sir.
I guess in a specific case, a board could make a specific determination to let someone else have the authority to construe their policy. Candidly, I'm not sure that's even delegable, because governmental functions aren't delegable as a general matter, and the statute doesn't provide for that specific delegation. In this case, there is no question that the board did not delegate the authority to construe their policies. Back to your question, and the commissioner has even addressed that issue in subsequent cases.
But you keep talking about this as being, you know, delegating its decision to construe its policy. We're talking about the decision whether or not to non-renew a teacher, and whether or not the teacher has violated, has gotten run afoul of the grounds for renewal.
We want to let the school board perhaps make that decision.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Thompson, I want to go back to your delegation argument. What prohibits the school board from delegating this power that you are talking about? Is there anything that prohibits them from doing it, since you say that we have to look outside 21.259 and look at their retained power? Is there anything that prohibits them from delegating to the extent that your opponent wants us to read the statute?
Delegating to the independent hearing examiner?
Yes, sir.
I guess in a specific case, a board could make a specific determination to let someone else have the authority to construe their policy. Candidly, I'm not sure that's even delegable, because governmental functions aren't delegable as a general matter, and the statute doesn't provide for that specific delegation. In this case, there is no question that the board did not delegate the authority to construe their policies. Back to your question, and the commissioner has even addressed that issue in subsequent cases.
But you keep talking about this as being, you know, delegating its decision to construe its policy. We're talking about the decision whether or not to non-renew a teacher, and whether or not the teacher has violated, has gotten run afoul of the grounds for renewal listed in the board policy manner. That means we've really got an adjudicative matter that's present in terms of actually deciding facts. We're at the administrative stage at this point. I'm a little bit confused about why we crossed back over into the general policymaking area when what we're really doing is adjudicating the conduct of the teacher and making a determination on whether or not her relationship with the school district should be severed.
The reason why they're inextricably intertwined is so-called finding of fact number 17, which, by the way, is almost verbatim the same as so-called conclusion of law number 4. It's very evident that the hearing examiner wasn't sure whether this was a conclusion of law or a finding of fact. is simply a statement of board policy in the negative. That fact-finding takes away from the board.
It's not a statement of board policy. It's a statement about her conduct.
No, it is a statement of board policy.
Why is that?
Board policy, DFBB local, reasons for non-renewal, quote, failure to maintain an effective working relationship or maintain good rapport with parents, the community, or colleagues. Finding of fact number 17, Joanne Davis did not fail to maintain an effective working relationship or maintain good rapport with parents, the community,
okay,
or colleagues.
Okay, but why, I understand that, but the key is, the difference is, your, the second thing you read have her name in it. It says that she didn't do it.
The two things it had were her name and a not. And other than that, it is a construction.
So why isn't the policy acting as the, it is the law in this case, and we're just applying the law to her fact, to her factual, her situation, and making a determination?
That statement as a fact is not an adjudicative or evidentiary fact. It is a legislative, ultimate, determinative fact, to use the words that are used in the context of the APA. Determination of ultimate facts, legislative facts, we believe are questions of law, or at least mixed questions that are reserved for the policy.
Why is it the legislative fact, the board's decision at the point in time it adopted its policy manual and said these are the grounds for non-renewal? Why isn't that the legislative fact? And the adjudicative fact, whether or not this teacher violated or gave right, you know, ran afoul of those grounds for non-renewal.
The application of the policy, the interpretation of what the policy means, is still a legislative fact finding. That is a policy function to give meaning to those words. Back to your example, that if the hearing examiner had said, I find that three kids actually transferred in one semester, but I don't think that's a big deal. We believe that the first part of that is a legitimate fact-finding. The second piece of that is not a fact-finding. That is an intrusion of the role of the board to interpret and construe its own policy. In one of the cases that the commissioner includes in his brief, and I'll just say this in closing, Your Honor, The commissioner in the Miller versus Houston ISD opinion, which is attached, says it must be concluded that the application and interpretation of a board policy is akin to a conclusion of law and can be modified or rejected by the board. The board has the authority to redesignate findings as conclusions of law. So where you're applying a policy.
What were you just reading from?
That is from the commissioner's decision, okay. Which is attached to the commissioner's brief. It's one of the exhibits that is attached to the commissioner's
brief. Isn't that one that came out before the new law was passed?
No, Your Honor. That is a subsequent decision. It's actually subsequent to this case. It's a later interpretation, if you will, by the commissioner.
Any other questions? Just one about the amicus brief. Amicus says, before the commissioner, the hearing examiner's fact-finding proposals are no longer entitled to any presumption of validity. Do you agree with that or not?
In this particular case, Your Honor, I do agree with that, and the reason why, if you look at section 21303, there are three sections. Subsection C is the harmless error. There should not be a reversal for a procedural error that doesn't affect the board's ability to make a decision. Subsection B deals with termination cases where you're actually interrupting a property interest. This isn't that case. Subsection A deals with non-renewal cases. And what it says is if the Board of Trustees decided not to renew a teacher's term contract, this case, the commissioner may not substitute the commissioner's judgment for that of the Board of Trustees unless the board's decision was arbitrary, capricious, or unlawful, or is not supported by substantial evidence. So in a non-renewal case, the commissioner's review is to the board's decision, not to the independent hearing
And then the way that the commissioner would review this one, in light of the arguments that are raised by the teacher,
teacher says, I guess, that it's an unlawful decision and looks totally at it because you couldn't do what you did, and therefore because it was unlawful, I shouldn't have been non-renewed. Is that the way it plays out?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the teacher's challenge has to be not that the board's decision isn't supported by substantial evidence, but that it is, in fact, an unlawful decision.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes today's arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.